when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the New Ethiopian Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the New European Podcast. My name's Richard Porritt, and I'm joined by Steve Anglesey.
Hello, Snowflakes. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
I am well. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good. Thank you.
I'm excited about our Donald Trump v. Joe Biden election podcast, which you are now listening to.
Oh, I was going to say, this is it, isn't it?
Yeah, this is it, yeah. There isn't another one.
There will be one next week where we will reflect. But yes, this week, we're going to have a look forward. So we will get to the news. Pretty newsy, certainly this morning, but pretty newsy week here in the UK. We're then going to talk to friend of this pod, friend of ours, certainly friend of the new European printed product, James Ball. And after that, we'll be speaking to John Kampfner. He's a writer for us, of course, and the Times, broadcaster, commentator. He's written a book called Why the Germans Do It Better. Is it a football book, Steve?
It's not a football book, but they do that better as well.
And then we will be speaking to the fabulous Bonnie Greer. Barely needs an introduction, does Bonnie Greer, of course. Playwright, political commentator, columnist from Day Dot for the New European. So she will be joining us a little bit later on as well. But let's... Oh, and of course...
I really enjoyed the way you said she needs no introduction and then gave her an introduction.
Yeah, I did. I fell into that sort of local radio show trap. Didn't I there?
I think that's where our future lies, isn't it?
She needs no introduction.
And I will give
her one. But I'm going to give her one anyway. Give her one. She didn't need one, but I'm going to give her one. I'm going to add some value. She's brilliant. I love Bonnie. She was fantastic when we did the live pod.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
And then we will crown a Brexiteer of the week, and I can assure you it won't be Bonnie Greer. Let's get to the news, Steve. What tier are you in?
I am in tier one. I have to make a lightning raid on tier three
at
some point over this weekend.
Are you going under the cover of darkness?
I am. You're still allowed to go to tier three, aren't you? I mean, as Italy, France, Spain, Germany, aka the sensible nations, all locked down, we can still go wherever we want. I understand that I can still go to the pub in tier three as long as I order a full English breakfast or full roast dinner or something like that. It's extraordinary times, isn't it? But I'm really taken with the idea of there's now tier one plus, isn't there?
Yeah.
Which is absolutely remarkable. It is. I think that is tier one plus as opposed to tier plus one, which is when you've already got a free ticket to COVID and you're allowed to bring a guest to COVID. And I just wonder how much longer, you know, how much they can stretch this, the government, because they're also talking about tier three plus, aren't they? And whether they want a rebrand. I don't know if you're aware of this, but last year, Virgin rebranded their economy. There's always been Virgin Economy, hasn't there? Then there was Premium Economy, and then there's sort of, you know, I think they call business class upper class, don't they, Virgin? Mm-hmm. But last year they rebranded economy, just economy on three different levels. And if you did COVID, if you did the tiers like that, tier one now would become COVID light.
Like it, yeah.
Tier one plus, if it was like Virgin Economy, would be COVID classic.
Got it.
Tier two would be COVID delight.
Ooh.
Because they call actual economy now economy delight. tier three would be premium COVID.
Ah.
And then any tier three plus has been suggested would be upper class COVID. And Richard Branson, I think, would sort of hire a limo and drive you to hospital within that. So exciting rebrands to look out for.
Who does COVID's PR?
I don't know. The PR for COVID has been bad, but not as COVID's PR been bad, or has it been? Who's been worse? PR, COVID's PR people, or Dido Harding's PR people?
I was thinking that, you know, there are certainly some government comms experts who might want to see if they can get a job with COVID. You know, because it's been pretty bad at number 10. Maybe now's the time to get out and work with a process that is actually doing what it set out to do.
Get into the pocket of big COVID. That's it. That's it.
That's it.
There is a lot of serious stuff to discuss, obviously. COVID is not.
If we don't laugh, we'll cry when it comes to COVID. So, you know, obviously more worrying, increasing cases. And with every increasing cases, there is an increase in deaths. And that's a terrible tragedy, of course. It seems like you mentioned there, Germany's closing its bars, I think, for until the end of November. I think we're expecting similar from Macron. He will have spoken by the time you heard this, but he hasn't spoken.
Bars and restaurants have closed, haven't they?
Yeah. So we're going back to full-on lockdowns in most parts of Europe. That doesn't seem to be something that's massively on the cards here to me. I'm not hearing a lot of people talking about it. But it doesn't seem like there's a lot of political will for it. We seem to be carrying on with the local lockdowns. And the really worrying thing, of course, a lot of people, I think someone from Sage was talking, I think it was earlier today, saying that the death toll from the second wave could actually be 85,000. Now, I know, and I actually agree with talking about worst-case scenarios, because those are things that bounce people into doing things and trying to, you know, help and stop the spread. So that hopefully is a worst case scenario and it will be far less than that. But the suggestion is actually that the peak will be longer than the initial outbreak. The peak will last longer. So the cases or deaths on a day-to-day rolling basis might not be as high as they were before, but over a longer period of time. And the other suggestion, of course, is that peak, that long peak, will be right in the middle of the Christmas period.
Yes.
There was a lot of talk coming out of number 10, certainly, but other areas of government as well, in the last, a month, 6 weeks ago, saying, you know, there will be a relaxation of the rules over Christmas. Don't worry about it. Everything will be fine. We'll get to a stage where we can go, right, we've got this far for the next week. Everything. I mean, can we? Can we actually? You know, Boris Johnson has said twice during this pandemic, it'll pretty much, you know, don't worry, it'll be over by Christmas. And both times he said it, I remember thinking, do you know what? That come back to haunt you, mate. And I can't see it. I honestly cannot see that we could sensibly and safely lift all restrictions by Christmas. Steve, what do you think?
I think it would be a strange thing to do. I'm wondering whether the government feels like their options have been closed off by Keir Starmer calling for a circuit breaker lockdown. I think you know, when you look at the developments elsewhere, a circuit breaker lockdown is probably what is needed. And look, we're going to see, aren't we, you know, the effects of, you know, if cases slow up in Scotland, in Wales, and also in Italy, Spain, Germany and France, then I think it's going to be very hard to resist some kind of national lockdown. I'm wondering whether we're heading for some kind of lockdown towards the middle of November anyway, that will be lifted temporarily at the middle of December, so we can get on with an orgy of spending, eating and drinking. It's really hard to know what is in the minds of this government. I think there are lots of interesting things politically about this. You can see the in all polls, Labour are creeping up on the government. The government are either losing support or our level. Labour are ahead in a couple of polls recently, still behind in another couple, but rising in the polls among older people. Labour, who are obviously very concerned about COVID, Labour and Keir Starmer appear to be attracting more and more support. And I just wonder. And I also think that some of the kind of the outlier stuff that we've seen. We've seen people like Isabel Oakeshott, Julia Hartley Brewer, who in August and September were saying there is no way that we're going to see, 200 death days again, and we're not going to see mass cases again. And here we are, that is happening. And for purely professional reasons, I read the Daily Telegraph newspaper every day, and I look at their online stuff every day, and the wave of crazy, the wave of denial that there would be any kind of second wave, or that it would be as bad as the first, seems to be ebbing away. And we're down to an argument now about whether it's for, we stay open just purely for financial reasons and balance that against lives lost, balancing jobs lost and businesses lost against lives lost, which is another argument altogether. But, these are unprecedented times, as they say.
What about the local lockdowns? Are they working? Is there any evidence they're working, without wanting to sound like an anti-vaxxer?
Well, I mean, there doesn't seem to be any real evidence that they're working, does there?
So that leads me to ask, would a national lockdown work anyway?
Well, exactly. I mean, I guess, in some of the places where the toughest measures have been in place, there is some evidence of it working. I don't think what's happening now is affecting anything. You're seeing a rise everywhere, aren't you, all across the country. Yeah. It's for all the reasons that we discussed last week. The spread of university students going back to university has been a big one, hasn't it? But cases were rising even then, and kids going back to school, but cases were rising even then. And they are rising even in the areas that some Tory MPs are harumphing about and saying, in Norfolk and in the southwest, we don't have this level of cases. But of course, cases are rising there all the time. The other day, here in lovely Norwich, three people died at the general hospital here of COVID related illnesses. So,
and we are seeing as well, and this is another example from Norfolk, we're seeing small areas that maybe are serviced by, or a lot of jobs in one particular factory, or, there's no need for us to name any specific factories here on this podcast because it's happening throughout the country, but there is a food manufacturing firm, obviously people work very closely together, and they've got a heck of a lot of cases there, and then that pushes up, it's all come from that one source, but it pushes it up for everyone else. And of course, these people are out in the community as well. So, yes, I think there are certain areas, and the east of England is certainly one of them, that have thought, oh, we're a bit immune to this, and we're not. No one is. It is in more densely populated areas. Of course, it's going to take hold quicker, but once it takes hold, doesn't it? And it's really tough to know what the answer is. I don't know what the answer is, but The government don't either, and that's what the worrying thing is.
That's the very worrying thing. Yeah,
kind of paid to do. Let's get on to the other big news.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, before we talk to James and we start doing this deep dive into the US election, or as deep a dive as it's possible for two shallow people to
well,
do.
Well, I'm going to say, I know about US policies. I know a great deal about it. So my dive would be into one of those pools where you used to, you know, when you went out of the changing rooms in old-fashioned swimming pools.
Oh, yeah.
A tiny little pool for just to wash your feet in.
To bathe your feet, yeah.
That would that's my sort of pool. And there'd always be some kid in there. Kids loved it in there, didn't they?
Just lying down, having a little splash. Yeah, yeah. There would be, yeah. Stop messing about. Before we do all that, you know, it's been a week that has reflected really badly on the big political parties in the UK. We talk about the Tories and free school meals, which last week we sort of said this is an issue which hadn't been picked up by the mainstream press on Thursday morning. It's certainly been picked up by the mainstream press after we recorded that podcast Friday and all through the week. Marcus Rashford versus the government round two. It's not gone particularly well for the government. First of all, though, I mean, Labour's what Keir Starmer described as Labour's day of shame on Thursday. We sort of knew this was coming. We didn't know what the findings would be. We thought that they were likely to be what they are, which is that the report of the Equality and Human Rights Commission has found Labour responsible for three breaches of the Equality Act in its handling of complaints of anti-Semitism between the party. They said that there was political interference within the office of the leader of the opposition, and so Jeremy Corbyn was ultimately accountable and responsible for what happened in the time. Keir Starmer made a lot of noises, didn't he, that you would expect. He said he wanted people like Luciana Berger to return to Labour, and he apologised to Jewish people and promised nothing like this would ever happen again. What we didn't really expect, I think, was the response of Jeremy Corbyn, which is what, and he said, I regret that it took, what he said, one anti-Semite is one too many. The scale of the problem was also dramatically overstated for political reasons by our opponents inside and outside the party. And that has led people to, and Keir Starmer was asked at his press conference, you know, so should Jeremy Corbyn be disciplined? Should he be thrown out of the party? So I'm asking you, you know, will Keir Starmer move now to discipline Corbyn, even to try and expel Corbyn or members of his circle? And if he doesn't, what will it say about Keir Starmer and about the period when he was supporting Jeremy Corbyn?
I think I'm not surprised by this. I'm not surprised by the findings in the slightest. I am still, however, completely disgusted with the Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. Firstly, I'll tell you what, I was, when this was coming through, I was talking to an esteemed colleague outside, and we were shocked by Corbyn's response. So shall I just read what Corbyn initially said?
Yes.
I regret that it took longer to deliver that change than it should. Yes. One anti-Semite is one too many. Here's the key bit. One anti-Semite is one too many, but...
Yeah, there's a but, yeah, why?
What? Are you joking me? There's a but? One anti-Semite is one too many, but the scale of the problem was also dramatically overstated for political reasons by our opponents inside and outside the party. Jeremy Corbyn still doesn't get it, does he?
Not on based on that, no.
He still doesn't understand what the problem was, and still going and Ken Livingstone has done this as well on the back of this, saying, you know, I am vehemently anti-racist. Well, yeah, but you say one thing and you do another when it comes to anti-Semitism. This was a party during the Corbyn years, and you know what? I might even start referring to Jeremy Corbyn's as the Labour Party, because it really wasn't the Labour Party as far as I could tell, certainly not in the upper echelons. It was flooded with entryists. dangerous left-wing entries. And I'm sorry if I'm offending anyone who's a Corbynista. Actually, you know what? I'm not. Don't like Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn's Labour was an absolute shambles that didn't hold a really crap government to account and is as much to blame about the complete Brexit chaos that we're about to face as the Tories. They're as bad as the Tories when it comes to Brexit. But on with regards to this, Keir Starmer needs to, I hope, it might have even happened by the time you read this, but if I was advising Keir Starmer, I would be saying to him, get rid of him. Get rid of Corbyn, because nothing is going to change here. You need to prove that you're the boss now. You don't want Corbyn's lot in the party. They're toxic anti-Semites, from the evidence we've got here. And to properly turn a corner and prove that Labour is no longer that Labour, they need to get rid of him. He can stand as an independent next time and sod him. Goodbye, Jeremy. Honestly, he needs to get rid.
I don't think that he will get rid, though.
No, I don't think he will. I don't think he will either, but he should.
Remember when Corbyn won and there was 3 months of noise about whether Tony Blair should be expelled from the Labour Party?
Well, I mean, that's an absolute complete nonsense. What Jeremy Corbyn and people within the leader's office have been found. And also, Labour has got to enact these by, I think, they've got to put a plan forward by sometime in the middle of December. And if they don't, then there could be legal action. And Labour, of course, will do that now under Keir Starmer, and quite rightly. But this is serious stuff. This is serious stuff that this report has found. And it has found that Jeremy Corbyn's Labour were anti-Semitic. I'm not suggesting that. You know, I tell you what else I feel sorry for. People who supported Jeremy Corbyn, people who believed in Jeremy Corbyn, people who went out there and knocked on doors for Jeremy Corbyn and thought that Jeremy Corbyn was the answer to what has been a pretty awful decade of politics in Britain, frankly. You know, a crap coalition, some crap referendums. I could see why people, especially young people, I could see why they would put hope, and I could see why the left would want a good, strong leader like that. Jeremy Corbyn wasn't that. So I'm as angry for those people, which I politically disagreed with almost throughout, but it's fine for them to have that belief. And they stood up for him. They said he's doing his best on anti-Semitism. He's trying. Well, clearly he wasn't. Those are the people I'm almost more annoyed for than the, you know, the people who are now coming back to the Labour Party that felt displaced by Corbyn's, the Blairites, et cetera, the more centrist people, of which I count myself as one. I almost feel more, because we were saying that. We can now say, we told you so. It's those people I feel were conned by Jeremy Corbyn's Labour. I feel dreadfully sorry for them. And I hope that they understand now and wake up and go, do you know what? I'm annoyed by it as well.
Yeah, me too. On the Tories and the FSM thing, I think what has been most remarkable about this isn't Boris Johnson saying, I totally understand the idea of holiday hunger. I think that he probably thinks that it means that he's quite hungry to just go on his holidays again. But it has been this idea, which is shared by people of the right, and I've never really understood it, that if you give people money through welfare, they will instantly spend it on widescreen TVs, crack, fancy cars. I don't know what else. Video games, etc., rather than feeding themselves. We just see that. And you know, Ben Bradley, we mentioned last week, his Twitter bio says he's the first blue brick in the red wall, and I think there's a serious misspelling there. He has said that previous FSM vouchers have effectively sent cash direct to a crack den and a brothel. I mean, the idea that drug dealers will accept free Happy Meals or meal deal vouchers from Sainsbury's from feckless parents is, I mean, I don't know. Maybe things have changed since my day. But, you know, who will forget the scene from Scarface when Tony Montana sold a kilo of prize cocaine in exchange for 100,000 chicken tikka wraps from Tesco's.
Say hello to my happy meal.
Yeah, absolutely. Ben Bradley also said he told one constituent that he was concerned because previously some food vouchers from Aldi didn't necessarily have to be spent on food. He said they could be spent on scuba diving gear instead. But this idea that...
Another favourite of the working class.
Exactly. And also a mention for Gary Sambrook from Birmingham Northfields. He tweeted, apparently if you disagree that vouchers is the only way to solve poverty, this is what happens. And then he shared an image of a graffitied wall which said, do you remember, have you seen this picture?
I haven't seen it.
It said, Gary Sambrook eats big dinners.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen it.
Somewhere else on the wall, it did say scum, which I think is probably what he meant. But Gary Sambrook eats big dinners. I mean,
that is the best way to attack this Tory government. Just keep saying they eat big dinners. I love that.
Well, we know now that Gary Sambrook does eat big dinners.
Eats big. I mean, this again. You know, I'm as angry about this from a competency point of view as I am about Labour. Because no, that's not true, actually. That's nowhere near true. But the thing is, what an own goal. We said this last weekend, but what an own goal for the government to score. There's a great cartoon, I don't know who it's by this week, but it was Boris Johnson throwing a ball, hitting Marcus Rashford on the back of the head, and it going back in the goal behind Boris Johnson. And that's exactly what this is, a massive own goal. And... you know, I've spoken to a group of business men and women out in this part of the world earlier in the week who are getting together to already start putting pressure on the government to make sure that this doesn't happen again at Christmas. You know, so this isn't going to go away.
No,
while it's got someone like, while it's got, you know, Marcus Rashford, who not only scores hat-tricks in 16 minutes, and you know, but also has the government on the run, this sort of new national treasure involved in it, it is not just going to go away. And I think if the government have really gone, we've just decided that we're not going to bow to celebrities on this, and that's the end of it. It just seems a bit short-sighted. I think for a government that's U-turned before, they should have just gone. And we said this last week as well, didn't we? They should have just gone right now for this half term, for Christmas, perhaps even for spring half term. We're going to do this. Then we're going to look at it. Then we're going to put other things in place. I mean, I'm dubious as to whether free school meals forever and ever, full stop, is that, you know, in the holidays is the way to deal with it. But right now, for a government to score such an own goal, it beggars belief as far as I'm concerned.
Hey, now, talking about bowing to celebrities, we've been joined by James Ball.
Hi there, what an intro.
How to describe James Ball? Writer for the New European, head honcho of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism.
Pulitzer Prize winner.
A winner of the Pulitzer Prize.
I'm going to have to slip you both a fiver for this again, aren't I?
Best-selling author of The System.
Yeah.
Which I believe has got a different title in America, James, hasn't it? I think it's called James Ball and the Sorcerer's Stone.
It's called The Tangled Web We Weave, which makes it sound like it should be a kind of gritty thriller. And alas, it is not.
What is the, for people who've not read it yet, what is The System before we start talking about Donald Trump?
So it's about the internet and how it really works, and why it's making everyone who is already rich and powerful even richer and more powerful, and screwing us all over in the middle of it. Obviously it's got suggestions to fix all of that immediately and easily.
Great. Okay. Well, you can check that out. Somebody who has become even more rich and powerful because of the internet is clearly the President of the United States. And you've written about him again this week. And, you know, I think the question that is on everybody's lips is that when the polls say it's going to be Biden, and when all the early voting suggests that it's going to be Joe Biden, why am I so worried that it's going to be Donald Trump again? And can you put my mind at ease?
I suspect I can't put your mind at ease, but it's because when we've been wrong, especially when we've been wrong and it's really kind of come as a gut punch, we are really, really wary against it a second time. It's the old fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. And most of us got 2016 wrong. You know, in the UK, most of us didn't predict Brexit. I actually got that one right. And most of us didn't predict Trump, and I got that one very wrong. And so when we look at something that looks like the same pattern a second time, we just sort of feel like it's going to end the same way. And we actually had this in the UK, where most of us got 2017's election wrong, in that we thought it was going to be a Conservative landslide, and it wasn't. And so in 2019, when every bit of evidence pointed more strongly that it really was going to be a Tory landslide this time, most of us ignored that evidence because we'd been fooled before.
Yes, that's true. Mention of Fool Me Once has recalled that fantastic interview with George Bush when he, do you remember when George W. Bush, rather than his dad, where he said, it's like the old saying, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, we won't get fooled again. He forgot the second bit and started quoting The Who.
Yes.
Let's just go over some reasons why people are worried about Trump, despite what you say, and one by one, and please shoot these down for me if you can. Number one is the idea that there are lots of shy Trumpers out there, which is a great phrase. Shy Trumpers who...
That's why I keep putting my mic on mute, actually.
Yeah. Shy Trumpers who don't want to tell... They're too embarrassed to tell the pollsters that they are voting for Donald Trump.
So, I mean, there's never been any evidence of this effect. They don't think it was a case of this in 2016 where people were lying about how they'd vote. They think they actually just made sampling errors, basically to do with the fact that educational status has become a big indicator of how you'll vote in America now. And it didn't used to be, and pollsters weren't correcting their groups for it. Shyness is not really a trait you associate with Donald Trump or most of his supporters. And so in the UK, there used to be a shy Tory effect.
Yes.
We don't really have any good reason to think there's a shy Trump effect. You know, the people who vote Trump are usually pretty happy to tell you they do so.
What about the idea which we mentioned with Peter Kellner last week or a couple of weeks ago, which was this notion which is coming out of the Republicans, and I guess there's an element of, well, they would say that, which is the Republican Party have been very keen to say that they are signing up hundreds of thousands of voters who have never signed up before, either to vote or as registered Republicans, and that will in some way affect the vote, as you know, the sort of the missing million affected the referendum in 2016, you know, when Dominic Cummings uncovered all of these people who'd never voted before.
Yeah, it's an interesting argument, this one. There's actually way more registered Democrats than there would be in a usual presidential election too. Both parties are sort of succeeding not just in signing up people to vote for them, but in the US you can actually register saying, yeah, publicly, you know, I usually vote Democrat, I usually vote Republican. We don't really have an equivalent of that here. But you'd expect that in an election as polarised and partisan as this one. It's quite a strange election to be somebody who actually votes and be a neutral and kind of, you know, a centrist on this one. It's sort of unusual to expect a big boost from new voters for an incumbent president. If you got to get people who don't usually vote out in big numbers, that would usually be 2016. It's hard to picture there being too many millions of people who stayed home for Donald Trump in 2016 who'd roll out for him in 2020. These people will exist, but I don't think there's that many of them.
There's also an idea that stuff like the Hunter Biden nonsense and the Joe Biden's so-called gaffe over transitioning away from oil is having a bigger effect on the race, or is resonating with people in a way that, you know, is not reflected by coverage of the mainstream media. Do you think that there's anything in those things at all? They're beginning to sound a bit desperate about these things to me.
Just as a bit of a brief bloody hell, have you seen the breaking news?
Wow, no, tell me.
Jeremy Corbyn's been suspended from the Labour Party.
Hooray! Oh, wow.
He has done it.
As discussed,
only his absolutely disgusting statement today. He's had the whip removed.
Wow.
Bloody hell.
We simply about 30 seconds before you come on, James, we said that is what should happen, but it probably won't. And yet here, as we are recording, dear listener, James Ball brings us breaking news.
Bloody hell. Sorry, I just
kicked out Jeremy Corbyn.
That's amazing. And the right thing to do. I mean,
good on Keir.
What do you think? Well, let's break off from Trump just briefly, yes, James, while we've got you on that. Just give us a quick thought on that. Was it the right thing to do?
Absolutely the right thing to do. I think there could have been a justification for not expelling Corbyn just based on the report. The report talked about huge systemic failings, said they came from the leader's office at the top, that he's out. You could have seen a quiet life, but Corbyn's statement minimised anti-Semitism and accused people of weaponizing it again. It was a disgusting statement. It made it very, very clear that the anti-Semitism that came to infect Labour came from the top. And so I think Keir had to act off that, or no one would believe the party has changed.
Absolutely fantastic.
It's got to be civil war.
I'm just looking now on the PA, the Newswire. So Labour Party spokesman said, in light of his comments made today and his failure to retract them subsequently, the Labour Party has suspended Jeremy Corbyn pending investigation. He has also had the whip removed from the Parliamentary Labour Party. Obviously, you guys will get a lot more reaction to that before you even hear this podcast. It will move on somewhat, but I will keep an eye on this as we're going along. But there you go. That is big news and the right thing to do. I think that sends a really strong message from Keir Starmer's Labour Party to Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, doesn't it?
And I wonder how, well, I mean, I wonder how calculated a move it is on the part of Jeremy Corbyn. You know, you don't issue, I'd be stunned if he was surprised by the reaction, Keir Starmer's response to this. And, you know, when he issued a statement like that, and clearly they've gone to him and asked him to retract it, and he's refused to do so. So maybe there is an element of pre-planned civil war in this. But I think it was the right thing. It became the right thing to do the minute he issued that statement, didn't it?
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, I think had he not issued the statement, Corbyn might have just been left to quietly go.
Yeah.
And if this was Corbyn picking a fight, of all the grounds to pick it on, the fact that you led a party which became so racist it broke the law, I think is probably the right sort of, that's not the fight you want to pick to sort of split from or pick a fight with Keir, is it?
Amazing. Incredible. So before we had that enormous breaking news, we were mentioning Hunter Biden, we were mentioning the oil thing. Do you see any of these as having influence on the race in its final days? And also the sort of the big Trump rallies that we are seeing now, which contrast very sharply in terms of imagery with the restrained stuff that Biden is doing.
So poor state authorities are actually tracking outbreaks to each place Trump visits because lots of people go in close proximity, not wearing masks. And so he is a one-man national super spreader event, which is ridiculous. But I think it's quite interesting, when Trump was on debate stages, he was talking about these scandals that clearly most Americans had never heard of. He's sort of lost his ability to talk beyond the Fox News bubble. That doesn't mean that stuff like the Hunter Biden kind of story has no effect. It probably helps mobilize his base and probably gets people who might otherwise just vote for him to donate money or to go and door knock. But Biden isn't Hillary Clinton. He doesn't work very well as a hate figure. he polls pretty well. His favorability is quite high. You know, he's sort of the vanilla ice cream of president. He's no one's favorite person, but dirt doesn't really stick to him. And so I don't think the kind of smear operation has worked nearly so well this time.
Mm. Yeah, I agree, actually. That's a really interesting point. And although a friend of the pod, Fred O'Rockwell, check him out on Twitter if you haven't already, would disagree that no one likes vanilla ice cream, that's a good point. He's sort of like the friendly uncle that's no one's favourite family member, but he's always welcome to come around at Christmas.
Yeah, exactly that. He's not the racist one who you sort of have to shove at the far end of the table and try not to talk to him too much. He's fine, you know. Everyone's all right chatting to him for 15 minutes or so twice a year.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Whereas Hillary Clinton had been hated by a large section of America for about 20 years before she ran for president. And, you know, I was out there just before the election and I've been out of there several times before, and the vehemence with while she was running, and the vehemence with which people talk about Hillary Clinton, even people of the left, is quite amazing. Tell me about social media, because obviously Twitter and Facebook particularly were huge for Trump last time, and it feels that is not a factor this time in the same way.
I suspect Facebook's being used just as much as last time. They actually tried to make a rule saying that no new political adverts could run in the final week. And Trump's got around that by running a whole bunch of new adverts with almost no promotion 8 days before, including some quite worrying ones like Trump won a second term, which you might clearly want to, you could see him putting out at 2 or 3 in the morning to try and claim victory prematurely. So I hope they take action on that. The social networks have tried to do a lot more this time around than they did in 2016. If anyone who uses Twitter will know, it's really annoying trying to do a retweet at the moment, because by default it makes you quote tweet. That's something just for the US election and will be gone next week. But I think Facebook ad spending on both sides will be a lot higher this time than in 2016. It's just that this time round, that's kind of how you do politics. And so I don't think we're quite so sort of scared of it because it's become so normalised.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. Tell me about what you'll be doing on the night then. Will you be going to bed early, or will you be up bleary-eyed?
Well, I will be staying up to file for next week's New European. I am doing an election night special, so I have to file by 8 a.m., so hopefully we'll have a clear result by then. I think the one unknown factor in this election night is usually TV networks call U.S. elections long before the votes are counted. It's completely bizarre to us here, but it's a little bit like when the 10 p.m. BBC exit poll goes up, everyone just goes to bed and goes, right, well, you know, the exit poll says that, we know the result. This is going to be a different one because different states have different rules about when you can count mail-in ballots.
Yes.
And Trump's campaign has been trying all sorts of shenanigans to delay or prevent their counting. We suspect on the day voting will favour Trump and mail-in ballots will favour Biden. And so the risk is that we get a very confused picture on the night and it's not that clear who's won. And Trump tries to leverage that in very similar ways to how George W. Bush did in 2000 and used the Supreme Court to kind of steal an election. The sort of hopeful sign on that is that will only work if the election's close. As it is, Texas is in play, which is, for anyone who knows US politics, absolutely mad. Texas should be among the reddest of red states. It's got 38 electoral college votes, and there is an outside chance Biden might take it. We're expecting Biden to win Arizona, which again is a strange thing to be saying. He's got a very good chance in Pennsylvania and North Carolina. If Biden's looking like he's heading towards a landslide, Trump still might sound off and refuse to accept the result. but you will see Republicans in that world very quickly ditch him from a great height. And so really, you know, it's going to be a shit show. Sorry if we can't swear, come what may, but the least sort of messy situation is a Biden landslide, because then at least Trump will get ditched.
And just, I mean, I think you've written about this week, but there's been a lot of speculation about Brexit if Trump wins and loses. There's this speculation that if Trump wins, it'll harden people's into going for a no deal Brexit, which will be, you know, sort of tempered slightly by a large trade deal with the US, or the illusion of a large trade deal with the US. Conversely, if Biden wins, they will try and claw some kind of deal with the EU and try and ease the tensions over the internal market bill and the border in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, between Northern and Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Do you see it making any huge difference no matter who wins?
I don't think when it comes to Brexit, Trump or Biden makes that big a difference, especially if the House remains Democrat. They're always going to need to pass a trade deal through Democrats, who are always going to worry about the Irish border. There's a lot of affinities there. I think a trade deal is vastly unlikely under either president. Biden would want the same kind of chlorinated chicken, hormone-fed beef type agenda that that sort of other people would. So, you know, Biden or Trump, I got to want that stuff. It's going to drop down a priority list for Biden. So, you know, the trade deal goes from very unlikely to very, very unlikely. I don't think either president would really intervene to punish Europe if we had any kind of no deal. So I think we're trying to sort of exaggerate our importance in the world. We're just not very high up either US president's priority list, sadly.
Sadly. Well, it's going to be an amazing night. I'm just checking. Joe Biden is going to win, right?
Well, I have put my colours to the mast on that and said he is absolutely going to win.
What percentage will I do
a sackcloth and ashes apology if it turns out I'm wrong. And for what it's worth, my money is on him getting 330 or more in the Electoral College.
Ooh, wow. Fate tempted. Wood is being touched
here.
I'm
going to regret this one, aren't I?
Yeah. It's a pleasure to have you on again, James. Thank you.
So thanks very much, guys.
I'll let you go and tweet about Jeremy Corbyn now.
James Ball, our breaking news
which
correspondent.
Which I can see he was doing during the conversation, listeners. Yeah. But anyway,
he can do multiple things all at once. I actually left that conversation to take a quick phone call from a current Labour MP, and I've got to tell you, they are delighted, absolutely over the moon at what happened about 20 minutes ago with Jeremy Corbyn being suspended from the Labour Party and having the whip removed. I imagine, like you said, though, Steve, Jeremy Corbyn will be reveling in this, because there's nothing the left likes more than a civil war. So strap in. So excellent news, Steve. We have been joined by the wonderful Bonnie Greer, massive friend of the New European and a big friend of this podcast as well. Bonnie, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Thank you. Hi. How are you guys?
We're very well. I guess we should probably start by asking you, as our American in chief, I guess. What do you think? We're less than a week away now. Do you feel that getting rid of Trump is in touching distance, or are you still worried?
Well, you know, I always tell people that, you know, they call it the general election, but it's actually 51 general elections, because the states and the District of Columbia elect the president of the United States. So you get a majority of votes, and then you're awarded X number of votes that then go into this thing called the Electoral College. And if you get 270 of those votes, you are president of the United States. So the big battleground states now are the upper Midwest, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, that Hillary Clinton lost, Donald Trump won, a state that's kind of in play, which is sort of shocking, is Texas, which hasn't voted for a Democrat, I think, in 30 or 40 years.
What, since Jimmy Georgia. Carter?
Hmm?
Not since Jimmy Carter, I don't
exactly.
think.
Arizona is in play, which is also shocking, because Arizona used to be a place where you went to retire. So that's how the Republicans always won. And now you new families and, you know, young millennials are moving in. So that's all in play. And Georgia is in play, which is another shock. But that has to do a lot with the metropolitan regions of Georgia, like Atlanta. They're starting to come out. So the tricky part is Florida, of course, because they have a saying in Florida, the further south you go in Florida, the further north you are, because South Florida is a lot of people who've retired from New York who tend to be more liberal, or university students. And North Florida is really South Georgia. So it's in that kind of red southern thing. And then we've got the old Rust Belt states of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan. That is what Donald Trump shockingly was the shocker that he won. And they are in play. It's very tight, especially in Michigan, where Joe made that little gaffe about fracking. And, you know, these people, my dad used to be, my late dad was a steel worker. And they're very, very, they're very tight in terms of the culture of steel. Not only that, but the, you know, the unions, all of that. And they voted twice for Barack Obama and Joe Biden, but they went for Trump in 2016. And they still may go for him again because he's bunged them a lot of subsidies. He's promised to keep oil, gas, all of that. So we'll see. But that's what that's the battlegrounds right now.
What do you think a Joe Biden presidency would mean for America? And specifically, what do you think Joe Biden could do to put a brake on this wave of tragedies that we see unfolding and generating more and more heat? The most recent one, obviously, involving Walter Wallace Jr. in Philadelphia.
Yes. I think one thing is Joe Biden can return the American people, or I should say, return the federal government to the American people. The federal government exists in order to protect and help the American people. And what Donald Trump has done is made it his own personal fiefdom and let everybody, let all the states fend for themselves. I mean, some of that has even been caught on tape with his son Jared talking to Bob Woodward. So he will return the federal government to the place where most Americans understand that the federal government should be, as a protector of first guarantee. And I think also the second thing is that Joe Biden, and he will get pressure from within the Democratic Party and the caucus to really look at police reform. I mean, part of the problem with police reform are police unions, which have evolved from really protecting police into kind of lobbying and self-defense organizations for the promotion of the police by, you know, by whatever they do. That's always the big defender. What you got meshed up into this is Donald Trump's base. And Donald Trump's base are white working class men. And what Donald Trump does is perform a type of masculinity that these men like. Donald Trump will lean on a podium in a crowd as the president of the United States and say things like, I'm working my ass off, which for Americans is not a thing the president says, but certain guys, certain people like that because it shows authenticity, it shows realness. So they feel very emotionally attached to him and he plays on the emotion. There are two lovely, I mean, powerful videos out that I would urge everyone to see to understand this. They're both voiced by the great actor Sam Elliott from, you know, Big Lebowski and Roadhouse and all of that. And they're put out to talk directly to this demographic, which I think is also the same demographic that supports Brexit. It is that white working class male who feels that he's being outpaced, outplaced, not listened to, doesn't have a seat at the table like he used to, certainly doesn't have a seat at the head of the table. His family is changing. His children are different. His wife is different. So Trump uses words like housewife, which I haven't heard for decades in reference to anyone except a drag queen I know who likes using the word housewife. And, you know, he uses all these buzzwords to endear these guys to him. And also the other thing is that the Republicans tend to vote on the day. So we don't know, because voting in the election began 3 weeks ago. So we don't know what's going to happen on the literal day of November 3rd, if there's going to be a red surge, if something's going to happen. So it's all pretty much up in the air. I don't care what the polls say. What you want to pay attention to are the local polls in the battleground states, because the president is elected by the states.
And it looks, I mean, it looks a bit, I think it was always going to narrow, wasn't it? But there are some.
Oh yes, oh yes.
There are some things I'm worried about. Pennsylvania is where he was 10 points up. It now looks like Biden's up by sort of five.
Michigan,
Florida,
Michigan's tight.
To, you know, 7-5 to now it's 2.
But the thing is, he can afford if he gets Arizona. If he gets Texas, if he gets Florida, he can afford to lose one or two of those, but not much.
Yeah, I still can't believe in Texas, but maybe.
Yes,
maybe
well, yeah, that's that. Through. Yeah, me either, actually. But Arizona looks good.
It does look good. What do you think another 4 years of Donald Trump would mean for America? And you know, if he was tempered by Congress, even if the Democrats do well there, but he still manages to win the Electoral College somehow, then what would another 4 years of Trump mean for America?
Well, it would mean, first of all, an enormous amount of litigation, because if the Democrats will hold the House, they'll probably win the Senate. But then that means Trump will be governing by executive order. Which he can do, which will entail the Congress going to the Supreme Court to ask if the orders are legal. The president is in charge of the federal branch of the government, so he can stack, he's already stacked the court, but he can also, his Justice Department, the Justice Department is his Justice Department because he names the Attorney General. And so what will be is 4 years of total stalemate and chaos, because nothing will happen. And Trump doesn't actually care as long as he doesn't lose the election. But also the most disastrous part is that the United States has the highest number, or close to the highest number, of people dying from the coronavirus. And Donald Trump has farmed out the response to the coronavirus to the states. So you've got 51 responses to this national health crisis. That's going to kill more people, and there's no doubt about it.
And the news over here seems to have settled on the idea that COVID is a polarizing factor in this race, and that Donald Trump's supporters seem to buy into the idea that it is all if it's not a hoax, then it's being overplayed. And you can see that from these events. James Ball was just describing them as super spreader events because they've.
That's what they are. Yeah.
But the thing is, Bonnie, that they look so great on TV, and it really it really worries me. Do you think that's going to have any sort of effect, or do you think that Biden might have already COVID might already have won this for Biden earlier on, with older people voting for Biden who previously would have been Trump?
I think what we don't understand here in Britain that's very important is that Donald Trump has been a media celebrity and been on television for 30 years. I don't even know what the equivalent, who in Britain would get himself or herself elected leader of a political party and then be prime minister who's been on TV for 30 years. Nobody exists like that. Also, we have the parliamentary system, so you have to go through that. But so Donald Trump is a fixture in a lot of people's homes. They think he talks back. And a lot of people like that. A lot of people like that. They love that he talked back to Hillary, who was seen as an elitist, as somebody who was just too big for a boost. They couldn't take her anymore. So they love the fact that he talked back. They love the fact that he does things like, you know, I'm working my ass off. They love the paranoia that he displays. They love the fact that he's not correct, that he eats, you know, they love it. And so he's endearing to a lot of people. And they also feel, you know, that he somehow, even though he's a well, I don't know how much money he's got, but he performs a billionaire, let's put it that way. They love the fact that he's a billionaire because a lot of people like rich people. They may pretend that they don't, but they like rich, self-made people. So Trump fits all of this. Also, he said that he loved the poorly educated. And what that means is he loves people who didn't go to Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Columbia, who don't live in LA, who don't live in New York, who don't live in, and that is a large group of Americans who resent that class of people. I mean, even I cringed when Michelle and Barack would go summer on Martha's Vineyard. You think, oh no, don't do that. But that's what they do because that's what they are. So people, there's a group of people who really, and they're in this country as well, resent intellectuals, professionals, because they think they're being told what to do by them, being overlooked by them, being told that they're stupid. And Trump plays to that, and he plays brilliantly to it.
What do you think the future is for Donald Trump if he loses the presidency?
Well, if the Attorney General of New York has anything to say about it, it'll be Sing Sing. you know, other than that, he'll be in litigation. He'll be in litigation forever. And he'd just be fighting various district attorneys. But certainly there would be an investigation into his links with China, because I can remember seeing Trump goods and shirts and things, and certainly stuff that Ivanka has done that says made in China. So we need to check that out. But definitely New York State has got him, and they're going to come for him as soon as they're able to get through to him.
Well, it's a lovely thought, Bonnie.
I'm cautiously optimistic, but you know, you never know. You just never know.
We are once again daring to dream.
Exactly. Never forget. Never stop dreaming.
Never stop dreaming. Bonnie, it's a great pleasure to talk to you as always. Thank you
so much. And thank you for asking me for this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie. What a superstar. Bye-bye. What a superstar Bonnie is. And that was wonderful to hear her thoughts there on the US election. And I think we can go straight to our next guest. John, are you there?
Yes, I am indeed.
Ah, fantastic. Wonderful. That was John Kampfner is, of course, a writer for The New European, also for The Times, broadcaster, commentator. John, we've just been talking to James Ball and then Bonnie Greer, you maybe just caught the end of there. And we're going to speak about your book, and we're really interested in your book in a little while. But how nervous are you? Because we and Bonnie and James are a little bit nervous. How nervous are you that we might still end up with another 4 years of Donald Trump?
Well, I've got money on it. Somebody about 3 years ago said to me, Trump was about a year into office. And I won't say who it is, but it's somebody sort of involved in politics and public life. And he said, I confidently predict that Donald Trump will be impeached or something else will happen and he won't complete his first term. And I said, no chance. He's going to see out his first term and I'll double it and I'll say that he'll win re-election. And I was fairly confident that was going to happen. And then obviously COVID engulfed the world from the start of 2020. And it's become axiomatic now to say that Trump is going to lose. Will he? I still think that Biden will prevail. I think the most likely scenario is going to be this gray area in which if Biden prevails, but by only a bit, then this will go to the wonderful new Supreme Court dominated by Trump. And we could well end up with a Trump by default, which would be the most dangerous of all the options. But if I had to stick my neck out, I would quietly predict, simply because of the number of people who have pre-voted and physically, and in that way it's not contentious, that Biden will win, and he might win a little bit more confidently than people are predicting.
Ooh, fingers crossed, John. Is there?
I'm not normally known for my optimism, because I predicted Trump, Brexit and Marine Le Pen, and she let me down in 2016-17. But I am slightly sticking my neck out on the slightly optimistic scenario, which, given everything else that's going on in the world, you've got to be optimistic about something.
Do you think there's one defining moment that has summed up Donald Trump's presidency? And is there any, you know, if he does lose, and I think we're all hoping that he does lose, apart from for your wallet's sake, John, is there any positive legacy at all that he leaves behind? Other than just an abject lesson in how not to be the president of the United States?
There isn't one particular moment that I think defines Trumpism, because every time you think there is something that is definitional, something else comes its way and knocks it off. For me, it's the image of this angry Trump sitting on his giant bed in the West Wing, eating his McDonald's or whatever else he's eating, and watching Fox and Friends and taking his cues and furiously tweeting away stuff with capital letters and lots of exclamation marks. And that is the picture that will define this presidency. To your point about, has everything been terrible? Well, again, I'll be a little bit unfashionable and say, no, not everything. His enough is enough approach with regard to China, I think, has been really interesting. Ooh. I mean, as ever with him, he's done it in the most lewd and unprepossessing and unattractive way possible. But it has made a difference. And if it is Joe Biden that takes over, or my other prediction is that maybe Kamala Harris will be president sooner than we might realize. But whoever it is, the China policy has been reset. And although as a result, it's a more dangerous world, I think it was right to have done that. And there are many aspects of the Obama legacy, particularly in foreign policy, and him saying a line in the sand with regard to Syria, and then that being crossed and doing nothing about it, and his and everybody else's, Britain, France, Germany's, everybody's kowtowing towards China, was abject. It was only reinforcing Xi Jinping's idea of, well, I can just sort of literally and metaphorically buy up Western countries. And so, yeah, I do think that was important and it was necessary.
That is interesting, because, you know, people of the left, I guess, don't really have a good word to say about him. I do think there is I think there's a lot of merit in that, even though it's been done in traditionally Trumpian clumsy and undiplomatic ways. On Tuesday night, then, what are you going to be doing? Are you going to stay up to watch this? Are you going to await the worst in the morning? And if you are going to stay up, what are the things that people need to look for?
I'm going to stay up with my family. We're all going to be sort of ready and raring. I don't know if we're going to make hamburgers or veggie burgers to mark the moment. I think we'll watch CNN, because you don't get that sense from British broadcasters or other broadcasters of that sort of on the ground feel. Sadly, my cable provider doesn't provide Fox News. It would be quite interesting to watch that as well. But no, so we're watching it, and the really important results apparently are going to be coming UK time, 1-2 in the morning. You should get a sense then of what's going on. Will it be either side or will it be chaos? And then in the early hours, either side of breakfast, I will be filing a report for a newspaper called The New European.
Yes, me too. Me too. I think it will be the, I think it will probably, for that reason, it will probably be the most sober American election that I've.
I don't know. I don't know. I might get one or two in.
Yes, I'm certainly hoping so. Just turning to your book then, Why the Germans Do It Better. There is a theory that the government, the British government, would be happy with a Trump victory for various Brexit-related reasons. For Germany, a Trump win would be a disaster, wouldn't it? Why is that?
I mean, it would be... I mean, most sober and sane countries and or governments, and I would leave the British one out
yes.
of that, are desperately hoping for a Biden victory. But no more so than Germany, because the whole post-1945 and the whole post-unification thinking for Germany was two things. One, that America was its guarantor of safety and security. It was also its sort of emotional and ideological lodestar, which was obviously problematic during the Vietnam War, and was obviously problematic during the Iraq War. And that huge sense of affection towards America, which they felt with John F. Kennedy, with Bill Clinton, with Barack Obama, can equally turn very sour very quickly. But it's a very close and it's a very intense emotional relationship. At the same time, the other sort of pillar of what makes modern Germany in terms of foreign policy and identity is the rule of law. It's multilateral institutions. It's that sense of a stable world. And Donald Trump, not to put too fine a point on it, does not represent that. And it's almost they will put up with anything as long as it's stable, it's mainstream, it's grown up, and they know how to behave. And Trump absolutely went for Angela Merkel in the first term. He was more rude about her than he was about any politician pretty much in the world. Maybe Sadiq Khan, but... he was absolutely vicious about her the whole time. And he sent to Berlin a guy called Richard Grenell as his ambassador, who was just a sort of Fox News presenter on speed and was just outrageous about Germany the whole time. He's now been rewarded with a top job back in Washington. And Trump has been trying to get in another, a successor ambassador, who's even worse. So if Trump does win, it will be absolutely vicious towards Germany, but it's more dangerous than that. I would say that the future of NATO is at stake. Yeah. Future of the European Union is at stake. This is where he has common cause with Vladimir Putin, his friend, in absolutely undermining both the institutions and the values of Western Europe. And 4 more years of Trump, in which he'll be completely unleashed, will, you know, it's not too fine a point to say that the future of Western liberal democracy is at stake.
Wow.
Well, that's a small...
which I think is more important than my 50 quid, by the way.
Just, yes, it's just a trifle. I mean, he has no relationship with Merkel whatsoever, does he?
No, I mean, he just tweets about... He couldn't stand when Time magazine made her person of the year. He went absolutely ballistic. He just found that as a sort of personal insult. No, he has none at all. And she's a remarkable person. She says, one of her biographers describes it as total impulse control. she absolutely never lets rip at people, but her body language does all the talking. Next time you or listeners have the chance to look at a video of Merkel with anybody that she finds, how can I put it, somewhere between repellent and problematic, just look at sort of her body movements. And Trump is absolutely one of those. Boris Johnson is another one. Putin is another one. And she just finds, she just can't get it into her head why people act like that in the way they do.
What do you think, conversely, what do you think a Joe Biden presidency would mean for Germany and for Europe?
Well, just by not being Trump, it will mean a lot. But beyond that, there's a lot of sober expectation management around Biden. I mean, some of these, if you strip away the Trumpian hostility and behavior, there's a lot of aspects of American foreign policy towards Europe that will stay the same. There are some that will change. So it seems very likely that sooner rather than later, Biden will rejoin and re-engage with the JCPOA, the European deal, the European and American deal with Iran, for suspending sanctions in return for Iran not pursuing nuclear ambitions, which Trump ostentatiously walked out of. And interestingly, the Brits, including Boris Johnson, which has been a great relief to the Germans, who otherwise don't think much of him, the Brits have absolutely stayed close to the French and the Germans on that. So you have an absolutely open division between the three European nations and America. But I think Biden will return things to normal on that, and he will certainly, one of the very first things he'll do, I reckon within weeks of taking over, if he did in January, is to reaffirm the Paris Climate Agreement, which Trump walked out of. And that, again, will be a very, more than symbolic, be a very important point. But on other aspects, I think there will be continuity. I mean, the general withdrawal, in all senses, of America from Europe will continue. The pivot towards Asia will continue. And essentially, the Europeans are sort of accepting that. And there's both the French and the Germans have produced a what they call an Indo-Pacific strategy, which is basically Asia and Australasia. And they're going to get the EU to fall behind that as well. And the Brits are planning something that, while that'll be separate, because Britain will be out, the EU won't be very different to those. So there's an acknowledgement that the big action is taking place in Asia. And so America is this sort of big brother comfort blanket is no more in Europe. At the same time, as I said before, the China policy will stay tough, and there'll be an expectation on the Europeans not to hug the Chinese too closely. Russia will be interesting. I think a hawkishness towards Russia, the Americans are very agitated by the German-Russian pipeline, Nord Stream 2, which is close to being started now, and the Trump administration has slapped sanctions on companies that are engaging with that. I'd be surprised if Biden changes that policy. So I think there'll be more tension there. But even where there are differences, and there are always differences, there are differences with administrations that get on as friends and allies. I just think the whole behavior, the whole dynamics will be different.
And just before we let you go, John, your book is subtitled Notes from a Grown-Up Country. What do you think it would need for Britain to become a grown-up country? And is there anything that Germany can learn from Britain, other than as we say, another example of how not to do it?
No, there is a lot. On the flip side, I mean, my book is, you know, the title is very binary, and the book isn't. I mean, it's clearly saying that Germany is a beacon. It's doing a hell of a lot of things well, but there are a lot of things that Germany doesn't do so well. It's very behind on tech. It's a very clunky economy. in which it's very difficult for startups to get going. It feels kind of old and old-fashioned, and that's all by German admission themselves. It takes a long time, you know, slow but steady is the German mantra, which was very much personified by Merkel, which obviously has its pluses. You know, we'd have none of this sort of bombastic nonsense and crazy decisions. Everything is thought through, it's very deliberative, but it can also be slow. And, you know, there's a lot of the sort of creativity and tech side of Britain that the Germans really do respect. I mean, everything about Britain's image at the moment is tied up with Boris Johnson, in that, you know, he was the architect of Brexit. It's arguable that without his leadership of an association with the 2016 Leave campaign, it wouldn't have won. So along with the technical success, there is the sort of ignominy of being associated with that. The Germans cannot get their heads around Brexit. They cannot, both the fact of the referendum result, but also the chaos that ensued. Their general questioning is always, well, if you put a question to the people with two possible outcomes, surely you prepare for both outcomes, don't you? And the fact that literally nobody had a clue the day after the Leave vote is not something that would ever really take place in modern Germany. So it's about personality in Boris Johnson, but it's about more than that as well. I've always argued that Brexit was not the cause of anything. It was a symptom of a much wider malaise in political culture and in political systems in Britain. We sort of continue with our sort of rule Britannia, make it up as you go along type approach to politics, which again, Germans find bizarre. And Brexit and COVID in their different ways have really shown up the structural weaknesses in Britain. And sure, we can get rid of eventually Boris Johnson, and whether it's Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer, or it's usually somebody who at the time of predictions, nobody has predicted. But fundamentally, it's my argument that Britain's sort of sense of sort of atrophication will continue until we do something quite dramatic with our whole political culture and political system. But there doesn't seem to be anybody in any of the main parties that's willing really to embrace that.
Yeah.
No.
Fascinating stuff.
True.
Fascinating stuff, John. Thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Your book, Why the Germans Do It Better, is out now. I believe the Times called it excellent and provocative. The FT said it was highly readable. The Guardian loved it as well. So I think for anyone who is...
Do you remember what the Telegraph called it?
I was going to leave that, John, but if you want to tell people...
Brexit revenge porn.
Well, I guess that's probably going to... Our listeners are going to love that just as much as...
When we put the paper back out next spring, we're going to put that on the cover.
Fantastic. Well, listen, it really is a smashing book, and it's an absolute pleasure, John. I hope we will get to speak to you again soon, and we can hopefully look forward to 4 years of Biden rather than four more of Trump. Thanks so much for your time,
John. Cheers to that. All the best.
Steve, we have had a multitude of superb guests today, haven't we?
It's been great, really great.
But now we've got to crown a Brexiteer of the Week.
We certainly have.
Brexiteer of the Week.
Welcome back, Steve. It's time that you crowned a Brexiteer of the Week.
I will. And first among Brexiteers is Councillor Glenn Thompson. From South Tyneside, he was a Brexit Party candidate. I think he's now running as an independent, and he is one of many Brexiteers angry about the news which broke this week that British citizens won't be able to use the fast-track electronic gates for EU citizens at airports and ports in Europe after the 31st of December. He said this was just spite, nothing else. And you do wonder if Glenn will now march on his local David Lloyd and demand to use their tennis courts, despite the fact that he's not a member of his local David Lloyd. He might well be, but you know what I mean. I wonder if it's fine for Glenn if the EU citizens use the ones that are for UK passport holders.
I don't understand where how people are confused about this.
It's amazing, isn't it?
I don't get it.
I demand to use your sauna, not despite the fact that I'm not a member of the local.
It's like buying a season ticket for Huddersfield Town and being annoyed when they won't let you in the Stretford End. I don't understand.
Yeah, it is something. Daniel Hannan, the brain of Brexit, is a fixture in this section. He was in it last week. And he has tweeted, I don't know if you saw this, Richard, it was absolutely amazing. Fishing is currently a tiny fraction of our economy, but there is vast growth potential in using fish in cosmetic and health supplements. Bones, scales, guts, heads, enzymes, almost all can be monetized. Hull and Grimsby could be reborn as farmer hubs. And I love the idea that, you know, Brexiteers said Britain was going to be the new Singapore. It was going to be an incredible tax-free place, which would bring in all these entrepreneurs and stuff like that, and now our ambitions are to become a mighty fish guts cosmetics hub, a bit like Dr. No had his island was built on guano, wasn't it? Dr. No, the Bond villain, his empire was built on guano. It all does sound a bit fishy, and do you not think other nations have thought of this before Daniel Hannan thought of it? And of course they have. You know, there is a small trade in cosmetics that is made from fish scales. And of course there's a trade in stuff like cod liver oil, but the idea that fish guts are going to turn us into the new Qatar is a bit fanciful. And do you know why? It costs an awful lot to create high value products out of these things. And most of fish meal, which is the bits that aren't a fillet of fish, and most of fish oil all goes to feed farmed fish and prawns, and fish stocks are disappearing. In any case, what Daniel Hannan is proposing is just not going to happen. It is, I'm afraid to say, a red herring for Daniel Hannan.
Daniel Hannan has had quite a week on Twitter. I'm not going to go into his tweets this week, but there's been some. I mean, I know they're out every week, but this week has been, I've spotted a few on my timeline. Check Daniel Hannan out. He seems to have, I don't know, he just seems to have, you know, he's always been a little bit Brexity, but he seems to be really going headlong into it now.
The Brexiteer of the week is our mate Liz Truss, though.
Trussy.
Obviously in charge of the Department for International Trade. And the tweet of the week that was even sillier than Daniel Hannan's fish guts explosion was they tweeted, the Department for International Trade tweeted, the bakers used a lot of soya sauce on the first challenge on the Great British Bake Off. So it's a good thing that it would be made cheaper thanks to our trade deal with Japan.
And then she's obsessed with this.
People asked how it would be cheaper than our trade deal with Japan, be made cheaper by our trade deal with Japan, because at the moment we have a zero tariff deal with Japan via the EU. And in fact, the EU brings in a lot of, the UK brings in a lot of soy sauce via the Netherlands, where tariffs are going to make it more expensive in the event of a no-deal Brexit. And there's going to be all kinds of paperwork anyway. So actually, quite a lot of the soy sauce that we bring in is going to be more expensive anyway. The Department of International Trade took this on board. And then they tweeted, under WTO terms, the tariff on soya sauce is 6%. Under our deal, they will be 0%. And then people said, well, that's not really cheaper, is it? Because it's 0% now, and what you're talking about. And then the Department of International Trade tweeted again, to clarify, thanks to the UK-Japan trade deal, soya sauce would be cheaper than it otherwise would be under WTO terms, on which we would be trading with Japan from the 1st of January if we had not secured the UK-Japan trade deal. If you have to issue two clarifying tweets about something, I think you've probably lost the argument. But the main thing that I've got to say about this is, who the hell says soya sauce? It is soy sauce, even though it might be made from soya, it is soy sauce. But we're actually getting the same deal as now, but a better one than we would get on WTO rules. And these are, of course, the same WTO rules, which Brexiteers have been saying are marvellous and nothing to worry about. So Liz Truss and her busy tweeting finger are the Brexiteers of the week.
We, Liz Truss is an MP in my part of the world, and I am a political editor in this part of the world. So I get a lot of stuff sent to me from Liz Truss. Very rarely is it to do with work she's doing in her constituency. And about three or four times last week, I had press releases from her talking about Japan. I've got to say that no one's really that interested, Liz.
It's Soy Sauce. So that was
congratulations.
It was a bumper edition, wasn't it?
Well, we had a very proper bumper edition last week as well, but we've had the, rather than just me and you rambling, although Liz Gerrard was brilliant last week, this edition has been filled with quality content and quality guests. So what should the listener do right now?
Well, if you enjoyed it, please leave us a great review on your podcatcher of choice. Go and buy the new European print edition, a fantastic orange Trump crossed out front cover from Chris Barker. We got two deals over on the New European website if you want to subscribe to the New European, www.theneweuropean.co.uk. You can get the next 13 issues for 25 quid. That saves you 14 quid. And that's a 6-month deal. Or if you want a rolling subscription, it's £6 a month for the first 3 months, then £8 a month thereafter. That will save you at least £4 every month. If you go to tneshop.co.uk, you can buy TNE merch, including TNE face masks. You can join our Facebook readers group. You can follow the New European on Twitter at the New European. And you can follow me on Twitter at Sanglesey, S-A-N-G-L-E-S-E-Y.
Or you can follow me at Porritt, P-O-R-R-I-T-T, which leaves me only to say thank you to our wonderful guests, James Ball, Bonnie Greer, John Kampfner, and, of course, behind the scenes, our producer, Matt Withers. Steve, thank you as well. We will be back next week. Until then, Mr. Campbell, play your bagpipes.
Here you go.
From true crime to football, Brexit to folklore. For more great podcasts from Archant, head to audioboom.com/channel/Archant.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Monday, it's the anniversary of the table knife being invented.
On Tuesday, we explain how the tradition of the two-minute silence originated in Cape Town.
On Wednesday, we recall the day King George III proved he was assassin-proof.
On Thursday, let's all eat cake. It's Marie Antoinette's wedding.
And on Friday, we discover how Buffalo Bill helped invent the Wild West.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.